Hello and welcome to the second podcast in our series, Living with Diabetes, brought to you by Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. In this edition, we lift the mask on Captain Insulin and champion DRWF volunteer Linwood Newman.
It was a flash outfit, but somebody put a nice logo on there, DRWF, and I wear it with pride.
DRWF's Lee Calladine explains how vital such volunteers are.
We let people set their own agenda. We don't beat them over the head with the diabetes stick, and they can get as much or as little out of the event as they like.
Dr. Partha Carr talks to us on breaking down the barriers between care in hospital and out in the community.
We always talk about we want to listen to your patients. Well, are we actually listening to people? People are busy, they have their lives, and you need to adapt accordingly to what 2019 is all about.
Eyes are in focus in this month's Staying Well feature with Hannah Beharrell and Jane Clayson from the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Diabetic Eye Screening Programme.
Having good vision doesn't mean that you can't have the sight-threatening retinopathy. That's why the screening is so important.
It is a common cause of blindness.
And Terry Smith, a community development and support manager at the charity Open Sight, who has personally experienced sight loss.
You do feel very alone. Nobody understands. I did feel as if the bottom had fallen out of my world because I didn't know what the hell was going to be happening.
Plus, we hear what happened when British TV presenter Dom Littlewood, who has type 1, took on a leg of a tough global yacht race, setting sail into a stormy Atlantic Ocean.
That's probably one of my biggest concerns, is we're going to be in the middle of an ocean. If something goes wrong, you know, it's not like you can suddenly call an ambulance or, call a rescue helicopter. You'd be too far for that. So I've had to give that a lot of thought, a lot of attention.
I'm Claire Levy from DRWF, the host of our monthly podcast, Living with Diabetes. So first up today, I've been talking to one of our champion volunteers, Linwood Newman, who has type 2, to learn more about the onset of his diabetes, how he discovered DRWF, and ultimately unleashed his alter ego, Captain Insulin.
Right. It's in two parts. And the reason being, one part I didn't know I had it, but I was going through signs, and the second part was 5 years later being diagnosed. The signs that I had were indicators, but of course, if you don't know what to look for, you miss them. And of course, you have up to 10 years before you get the effects, let's say, of complications. So fortunately, that didn't happen. It was a blood test, and all of a sudden, the next thing, because I was still in the military at the time, I got a call in and they said, we're sorry to tell you this, but you have diabetes. It was 1984 in the winter when I actually developed it. And that was 1989 when I was diagnosed. So in 1984, I had a fall and I was on a platform that was probably 6 or 7 feet off the ground. It was a control center. We were in the cruise missile program. And as I was coming out of the little control building, I stepped off the icy step as it was snowing there and everything. And I remember the corporal saying to me, "Sarge, that was a 10 somersault, but a real crap landing." Because I bent my leg in a direction it's not supposed to go in and it snapped back. If anything, looking back, it was probably the shock of that accident occurring that may have triggered it. I was probably destined to have it anyway because my mother had it. My father, in much later years, although never diagnosed, he had it. Of course, my brother had it as well. It was only, let's say, of a family of four. It looks like all of us had it in that sense, but at different times.
Just talk about the symptoms that you now know.
It was during our field operation that I came back and my feet were cold. Now, I'd been home for a whole week from us being out on exercises and my feet were still cold. So, unfortunately, what do we guys do? We blow it off, don't we? It's a very bad thing, but I have to say, guys, we are bad at this. Mm-hmm. And primarily, it disappeared. And I think there was probably one or two more times that it happened. Then it went away. No more signs. You don't know much about the diabetes. You never asked your mother when, you know, let's say when she had it, what she was going through. These are the things you regret and wish that if you could go back in time, you would do. So I'm kind of learning on my own. But another little chapter, I would say, along the way, okay, now I have the diabetes, and it was seeing my mother for the last time. When I went to visit her, here was a woman who was very much as active as I am and everything, loved to dance, was always running up and down the stairs. And there she was in the hospital, blind and missing one leg. She had an amputation. Now, that really hit me hard. And I feel that because then at that point I had diabetes, I thought two things. You're in the military. You're fit. When you get out, you will have to stay fit for the rest of your life. Two, she cheated. A chocolate bar here, something there, something there. After a while, you forget about cheating. And when you forget about cheating, that's when it becomes very dangerous. And she'd reached that particular stage where you kind of forget that you're looking after your diabetes. And of course, the blindness and the amputation was it. And I knew that when I got a call in the morning, and it probably would be in the morning, that I wouldn't even have to question what the phone call was. And of course, I got the early morning call, and I knew. That gave me the impetus to be in control of my diabetes, to look after it.
You very much took it upon yourself to learn as much as possible. And
oh, yes.
So can you just talk about some of that and the education that you did?
Just going off the top of my head, you have two. Expert patient was at one point that I took. Another one basically was a combination. I cannot think of the acronym right now, but again, they show you how to divide your carbs. And that was useful because then you can appreciate the carbs that you're taking in or not. And just keeping that balance and control as best you can.
Were you on tablets at that point?
I started off on diet,
right,
and then I moved to tablets, and then eventually it was tablets and insulin. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's where I'm at now.
And how long before you were prescribed to go onto insulin?
The insulin came in November 2002.
Okay. How did you feel about that?
I felt that I had failed by that time. It's just a natural reaction. You think, oh gosh, you've gone through everything and, you know, now they're going to put you on insulin. Yeah.
So tell us about finding out about Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. How did that happen?
That was back in 2006. That's right. That's 2006. Funnily enough, I met Lee. And Lee and I were taking a diabetes care course with Southampton University under the Open University, as it was. And that's where we met each other. And, of course, I didn't know the existence of DRWF. And obviously everything grew from that time on.
Lee Calladine, event coordinator at DRWF, told us about his work with Linwood.
I did a Open University course, diabetes care. It was a course for people living with diabetes and healthcare professionals. It was a home course, but every few weeks we had to go to South Downs College near Portsmouth and have some tutor sessions. And I met Linwood there. And we hit it off straight away and started talking about the charity and what I do and what he was doing at the time. And one of our walking events was just coming up and Linwood decided to book himself onto it. It was in Shropshire. We went to the Longmynd around that area and Linwood came along, had a great time. And the rest was history. He became a volunteer. He came to our wellness weekends, wellness days, just to check them out and see what they were all about. he loved those, and he started doing more and more for us. And he's become a great friend of the charity, an amazing volunteer, probably our Uber volunteer, I would say.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a new monthly podcast from DRWF. And we'll have more from Linwood and Lee a little later on the creation of DRWF's superhero, Captain Insulin, and Linwood's latest role on the editorial board of our newsletter. Accessing professional medical help and support is vital, not only in formal hospital settings, but also out in the community. I spoke to leading diabetologist Dr. Partha Carr, a consultant at Portsmouth Hospital NHS Trust and Associate National Clinical Director, Diabetes with NHS England.
The role of a diabetologist is probably for the whole population. It's not just for a local hospital or a local community. So I think terms such as community diabetologist is a bit like a tautology, because if you look at it from space, the hospital is part of the community. It's only in the NHS we come up with such terms such as, you know, hospital and community, and thereby all the disputes happen. If you think about diabetes, and your patients don't choose where they are, they will see wherever they are seen. And I think as a diabetologist, thereby the role is across both hospital and the community. So with that in mind, that's pretty much what we have tried to create locally, whereby it's the same team which works inside a hospital to do high-end stuff, such as, you know, technology or antenatal diabetes. But outside in the community, you've got a broader role of educating, support, you know, talking about safety, making sure frail people are looked after properly, educating so that you can pick up foot disease early. So it's a broader role, and that's the whole point of primary and secondary care. I mean, these are just terms at the end of the day. You know, the NHS, it's all funded from one pot. It doesn't really matter. These are all artificial barriers in my mind, and diabetes is well positioned to bridge that.
Yeah. So education is key, really, to improve diabetes self-management. How do we encourage people to take up diabetes courses, and is there more that can be done?
Yeah, so I think if you look at it from a healthcare professional point of view, it's all a little bit sort of fractured as to how an education is provided, and that doesn't help. But I think asking people just to attend programs, and that's the same thing when you transfer that on to patients. You know, we have a debate about, we always talk about we want to listen to your patients, but then when it goes back to education, we seem to always say that, but there needs to be only one way of them attending their education, which somehow seems a bit weird. And I would always say, well, are we actually listening to people? People are busy, they have their lives, so we need to create that opportunity for them. It could be a digital, it could be online, it could be in the evenings, it could be a mixture of stuff. So if you want to drive up attendance to these events, just laying them on is not good enough. I think you need to adapt according to what 2019 is all about.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying that one size doesn't fit all.
So that
navigation, you know, how do we help people to navigate? Often people are older, if they're diagnosed with type 2, maybe not quite so tech savvy.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's where you have the mixed approach. So I think rather than going to sweeping statements, so I think I always say that there's a mixture of people who are elderly, who are tech savvy, and who are not tech savvy.
Yeah.
So it's creating those options. I think what happens to a lot of people, and you see that at both ends of the spectrum, whether you're elderly or younger, we either are saying to them, come to a classroom, or we are saying, just go digital. Well, I think if you put down a series of options in front of them saying, well, actually, the option to do this in the day on a weekend, or it could be an evening, or it could be online, or it could be a mixture of both, and let people choose. I think that's the way to probably do it. And speaking as somebody who's got elderly parents, I know exactly what they would choose. So it's about giving them those choices.
Yeah. But on the flip side of that, you know, you've pioneered the use of social media, especially Twitter. Mm. You've got 15,400 followers. Can you say why you started using Twitter? How does it make a difference, and what people can do with that online community?
So I think that's a very different population sector. But I think if you look at the type of job that I do, which is very focused a lot on safety and technology, you pick up a lot of stuff from social media, what people talk about. Mm. But I think more importantly, there are two folds to it. I mean, first of all, it flattens the hierarchy.
Yeah.
So you can actually have a conversation with people. People see the human side of you. They know what I am. I'm not hiding behind an official role. I'm coming out and saying, look. And I think it's about being honest. So if you start saying glib things from behind an official role that will deliver everything and everybody, well, you can't. So no. I think it's being open and honest about it. So that helps. And I think people are then more respectful and talk to you in that sort of vein. And the other thing is learning. So books or education and the training that we go through don't make us interact with people living with diabetes so much. But this gives you an opportunity. This gives you ideas. This gives you some things to road test. And so things like, you know, let's say language matters and stuff that we have done has come a lot from social media. So that sort of resonates. So it's a mixture of things, really.
So that diabetes online community, what do you think it's done for people, especially living with type 1? I'm aware that they are often quite isolated. They maybe don't know anybody else with type 1.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's that's, again, the peer support network group, isn't it? That's sort of quite powerful thing about people talking to each other, people sort of saying, yes, I can do that, I can do this. And that sort of works really well. So they talk to each other, and the best will in the world, healthcare professionals can only see you 1, 2, 3 times a year. And if you have somebody you can bank on more regularly to give you good sort of advice and tip and living with it, so much the better.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a new monthly podcast from DRWF. Now it's time for our regular Staying Well feature, and today the focus is on eyes. I spoke with Hannah Beharrell and Jane Clayson from Hampshire and Isle of Wight Diabetic Eye Screening Programme on the importance of regular eye checks, awareness of the potential problems that can arise, combined with good management of your diabetes.
Okay, I'm Hannah Beharrell. I'm a screener grader and engagement manager at Hampshire and Isle of Wight Diabetic Eye Screening Programme.
Hi, I'm Jane Clayson. I'm a screener grader for the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Diabetic Eye Screening Programme. I'm also an elected member of the Bars Council, where I assist on the Diabetic Eye Journal.
What is diabetic retinopathy and how common is it?
Okay, so diabetic retinopathy basically means disease of the retina caused by diabetes. So it's what happens when you've got lots of glucose in your blood, and it can damage the small blood vessels in your retina, and that can lead to sight loss unless it's found and treated in time. So there are different levels of retinopathy. You've got background retinopathy, which is the earliest stage that we can detect with a screening test, and that's really quite common, but it doesn't cause any sight loss. So it just means that there are some mild diabetic changes that we need to monitor with routine screening, but you don't need any treatment for background retinopathy.
And features of background retinopathy can also come and go with good blood sugar control. So 1 year you might show signs of background retinopathy, but the next year they might have disappeared. So you just don't need to panic if you get background written in your results letter.
Okay, so that's quite common. A lot of people with diabetes have background retinopathy. It's not a disaster at all. If it progresses, it can progress to proliferative retinopathy. When that happens, it means that the mild damage has accumulated, and it's made the retina so oxygen starved that to try and get some more oxygen, it's grown out new blood vessels to try and increase its blood supply. No one really knows why the eye does that. It doesn't really work. And it causes problems because they're quite weak vessels. They're prone to breaking off and they can cause really big bleeds. They can also turn to scar tissue and cause traction and tightening on the retina. And that can lead to tears and detachments and sort of much more permanent tissue damage. And that's much harder to fix. But fortunately, it is a lot less common. We refer in Hampshire, we have over 110,000 people on our register. We refer a few hundred every year for proliferative retinopathy, so it's much less than 1%.
You can also get fluid leakage within the retina, which we call diabetic maculopathy. This is more common than proliferative retinopathy, but it's less dangerous. It can cause blurred vision, but not a sudden blindness.
Are there any other eye conditions? You've mentioned some there caused by living with diabetes.
When your blood sugars go go very high or very low, that can cause short-term changes to how your eye focuses, and that can cause blurriness, which a lot of people notice when they're newly diagnosed. But it's nothing to do with retinopathy. It's a short-term temporary thing that will tend to resolve as your sugars come down. Mm. You can also get cataracts earlier with diabetes because of those, the lens is sort of changing because of the sugars on a sort of short-term basis. It can, in the long term, it can make cataracts develop earlier. Mm. And they can develop faster as well. So usually they take years to ripen until they're ready to be treated. But they can come along in as little as 6 months.
So who should be screened and why is it so important?
Everyone with any type of diabetes from age 12 and upwards who is able to benefit from screening, except for people with gestational diabetes, as that's short term. Screening is designed for conditions where you need treatment for something before you get any symptoms. So you test everyone who is eligible to find the people who need more tests or possible treatment. But your vision on its own isn't a reliable test at all. Having good vision doesn't mean that you can't have the sight-threatening retinopathy. That's why the screening is so important.
And it is a common cause of blindness in the working age population. But as you were saying, figures have come down, haven't they?
It is. It was the leading cause until the screening programme started. And then it came down. And then I think it may have gone slightly back up again because the numbers of people with diabetes have gone up.
Right.
So it's sort of vying for first and second place. Yeah. With other conditions like glaucoma and AMD and cataracts. But yes, it is a common cause of blindness.
Yeah. And what area of the UK does your service cover?
We cover Hampshire and the Isle of Wight.
OK. And so there are other services very similar in other parts of the country,
there
yes?
There are. There's a national screening programme which sets the standards for eye screening, and every local service has to adhere to those standards. They have to report on certain aspects of their performance. So it's very standardised across the board in terms of what you do and why. But each local programme does things slightly differently in terms of where their clinics are, how they recall patients, that kind of thing.
And how often are people living with diabetes called for screening? And where do you do your screening? Is that the same across the UK?
We do our screening in a mixture of locations. Some of them are small hospitals, some of them are GP practices or health centres, and some are community centres. But they're all indoor venues. Some services use a mobile service where you have a vehicle going around, which is quite good for rural areas. But it does vary. Sometimes you have one big diabetes centre in a hospital where you have everything done at once. Mm. Ours is a little bit more specialised and separated out. But you can find all of the venues on our website.
So how often are people called?
Every year. Okay. Every year for routine screening. There are some exceptions for other screening pathways. So if we see something that doesn't quite need a referral, but we don't want to leave it for a year, screening programmes can, at their discretion, bring people back a little bit more frequently if they want to monitor something, but usually it's once every year.
OK. So if people are worried about their eyes and eyesight, what should they do?
If you haven't been to screening and you're overdue to have your screening test done, then get that seen to first, mostly just to rule it out as a cause of sight problems. And if you aren't sure how to contact your local screening programme, your GP practice will know, or you can find it online. If your screening is up to date, then the next thing is to check that you don't need glasses or an update your prescription. So a full eye test with an optometrist, where they will check the whole eye. We only look for one thing, so there are non-diabetic things that we can miss.
Yeah.
But the optometrist will look at your whole eye and they'll decide if you need glasses. 9 times out of 10, that's the problem.
Yeah. So what about people who've successfully put their type 2 diabetes into remission? Do they still need to attend?
Yes, is the short answer. So putting diabetes into remission through diet and exercise is quite a new thing. So I don't know that the level of risk is there's not enough evidence really to say they don't need to be screened. So we screen out of caution. We tend to think of it as a bit like having very well-controlled diabetes. But if that process of retinal damage has started, it can sort of roll on. Even if your sugars are now okay, it can sort of snowball slightly. So the very first cell damage that you might get is not visible on any test that we have. So the background stage is a little is not quite the same as the very early cell damage. It takes a little bit of time even for the background to show. So we don't know who might develop background, and if you get background, we don't know who might develop proliferative. So we screen everyone just in case.
Okay.
So we have some patients who are considered by the GP to be in remission, but some of those people do still have background retinopathy. And the only exception for this is if you've got steroid-induced diabetes. So if it's steroid-induced and you're no longer taking steroids and you don't have any clinical signs or symptoms of diabetes, then your GP can decide that you don't need screening anymore. But that's the only exception for steroid-induced diabetes.
I just wanted to add, it's always important to attend your optician's as well as screening, but you should also seek urgent professional advice if your sight suddenly worsens or becomes distorted, or if you lose all or part of your vision, or you have a sudden increase in floaters, just because this may need treated urgently. Normally they'd be absolutely fine, but it could indicate something else. So it's always good to just go straight down to your local eye casualty or phone 111 and get advice there.
Yeah, any sudden loss in sight, screening is not the place.
No.
No. It's that. So if you have an urgent concern, then just go straight down to an eye casualty.
Someone who's had first-hand experience of dealing with eye problems associated with their diabetes is Terry Smith, a community development and support manager at the charity Open Sight, which provides practical support for blind and partially sighted people across Hampshire.
To be honest, Claire, I was thinking about this over the last couple of days, and it's only when you're prompted to sort of think about how time has passed and how things have changed, that you realise actually, or I did, goodness me, I've been a diabetic for 44 years.
Yeah.
And I can remember very clearly some of the poignant memories of being diagnosed, the run-up to it, going into hospital, and various sort of goals, so to speak, that have hit me over the years. The biggest one, obviously, is when it was agreed or diagnosed that diabetes had affected my vision.
Yeah.
I was 11 when I was first diagnosed as being a diabetic. It was only perhaps when I went for an eye test, this is going back probably 20 years ago, and surprisingly, thinking back now, the optician at the time simply tested my vision.
Yeah.
And maybe that was a thing of the times, I don't know, rather than perhaps looking, as we know opticians do now, at the back of our eyes for our eye health.
Mm.
So he tested my vision and prescribed some glasses. I thought, great, this is going to be good, really good, because at the time, my vision, I thought, was getting a bit misty, but I put it down to my age, being so old in my late 30s, you know?
Yeah.
But the glasses didn't actually make my vision any better. And therefore, my wife said, you know, this isn't really very good. You should go for your eye screening. And I did, and I can remember very, very clearly that the photograph taken of the back of my eye just showed a complete mess and mass of very fine blood vessels, which were causing scarring of the retina. It was at that point I was signposted to the local eye hospital, where the consultant there had a look. And I think if she had been a motor mechanic, would have drawn air through her teeth, you know, they look at an engine that's blown up, but she didn't, because she was a clear professional, clearly. But the outcome was just the same. Well, actually, Terry, you're going to need to have some laser treatment to try and rectify this problem. And I can remember very clearly leaving the hospital, not knowing what on earth was going to happen, but actually hearing somebody who was very professional, very knowledgeable, say that there was something wrong with my vision, left me a feeling of complete hollowness.
Yeah.
And fear, frankly, because I didn't know what was going to happen.
Did you know anybody else that had ever had treatment?
Not a clue.
No.
Not a clue. And probably when you meet, or I mean, I meet lots of visually impaired people in my job now. And in the main, a lot of people say, I felt very much alone.
Yeah.
And that is true, very much even today. My brilliant family and friends and my wonderful colleagues that I work with, nobody knows what it's like to live with severely reduced vision. A couple of my colleagues do because they're in the same boat. Mm-hmm. But the fact being, you do feel very alone. Nobody understands. And certainly on that day, I did feel as if the bottom had fallen out of my world because I didn't know what the hell was going to be happening. And subsequently, over the next 2 or 3 years, lots of treatment, vitrectomy. I had detached retinas in both eyes. I had air bubbles to hold the retina back in, gas bubbles, oil bubbles. I had to do posturing twice. Posturing is where you have to keep your face facing downwards for a solid period of 2 weeks without exception, so that the bubble that's been inserted to push your retina back into place is held in the right position. That takes some doing, believe me. There's no, oh, you can have an hour off or half an hour off. Everything that you do for a solid 2 weeks is looking at the ground. And the way that I dealt with it was to lay on a camp bed, looking at the floor. And that's how I spent two weeks, to try and push the retina back into place. And to a degree, it did work, but the subsequent laser treatment that I had in both eyes left lots of scarring, which meant that my vision was very poor, to the extent that in my right eye I had to have an oil bubble to hold the retina in because it had more weight to it, and sadly because the retina wasn't re-adhering, the oil bubble was left in perhaps a little longer than it should have been. But what was the alternative? And regrettably, when it was removed, my eye had closed down because of the trauma that it experienced, so I have no sight at all in my right eye. Our vision, our eyes, are enormously precious. Sadly, if a condition is diagnosed and it isn't treated, regrettably, it doesn't usually get better.
Mm.
So anyone who has been recently told the news of being a diabetic, don't worry, but just be aware that a little bit more care, a little bit more thought is all that's needed. Doesn't have to be difficult, doesn't have to be hard, shouldn't get in the way.
Do you want to just tell the listeners about your event? And obviously it's for people in that area, but do you want to just flag if they wanted to come along?
The Eye Contact exhibition from Open Sight Hampshire is at the Aegeus Bowl, which is the home of Hampshire Cricket, in West End, just on the outskirts of Southampton. It's on Wednesday, the 25th of September, from 10 o'clock until 5, and there is free entry and free parking. All of the leading suppliers and manufacturers of technology, aids, equipment, all linked to visual impairment, service provision, not just within our area, but across the country, will be on hand. We have a couple of fantastic guest speakers this year. The first is Mr. J. Self, who is a paediatric consultant, and the work that he's doing at Southampton Hospital in terms of children's eye health is absolutely mind-blowing. Our other guest speaker is Professor Andrew Lowtree, who is internationally renowned in terms of his work in fighting blindness, and he specialises in looking at treatments and research for RP and macular degeneration. So those two guest speakers on their own will certainly attract a lot of attention. But we welcome everyone to come along. It's completely free. There's lots of other side exhibitions going on as well as the main event. And it would just give everyone who attends a better knowledge of what's available should they be faced with any concern with their eyesight and eye health.
And what's your website address, Terry?
Everything can be looked up, Claire, at www.opensight.org.uk. We can be followed on Facebook and Twitter. And of course, irrespective of where anyone lives, any concern with their eye health, don't let something overly worry you, but should there ever be an occasion where there's something which is perhaps a little out of the ordinary, a little discomfort or something that doesn't feel right, don't delay. It is probably nothing to worry about, but refer without delay to an optician or to a GP or indeed to the local emergency department of your eye clinic at the hospital.
Terry Smith.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a new monthly podcast from DRWF. Now, let's return to our chat with volunteer Linwood Newman and DRWF's Lee Calladine on the creation of Captain Insulin and preparation of our next newsletter and wellness days.
You don't want to miss an issue of diabetes wellness news, because you might find that particular thing that may have been of interest to you is there, let's say. So that's really important. To miss it, it's almost like missing, you know, something very important. In fact, I seem to have gone almost 4 or 5 months straight on helping out with it recently. One, I learn a lot when I see the thing, because there's a lot of things that are going on. In fact, probably the hardest job for the editor is to sit and decide what stories to put forth. But I see the relevancy in everything that's done in that. And, you know, you want it to read well. And I went as far as to take a proofreader course because I thought that would be a bit helpful. And we want to be accurate with the information. This recent issue, I found subsequently, just based on one of the pictures in there, I did a little research to add to that story just to explain the item that was in the story. And, you know, you sort of feel good that you've actually contributed a little more, let's say, for it. You look at the space and you say, might be able to fit that in. But again, you're right on top of new science that's going on. You're right on top of the research. You're right on top of looking at other volunteers and looking at fundraisers. They're all important ingredients, let's say, in the whole thing. You feel like you're really in the middle of something like that.
So, and, what would you say to somebody to recommend our wellness news to them? Why should they sign up to receive it?
You got coverage if you're a type 2. And there's a lot of information coming down the road on type 2. Type 1, yes, there's a lot of things that are going on there. I mean, in both cases, let's just use them as an example, that there's new science that's working to make life a bit better for them. Quality of life, I'll call it. We won't quite say there's a cure for type 1, but if somebody gets an islet cell inside the liver, which then goes out to the pancreas and creates the insulin, well, we have something, because although we can't technically say they're cured, well, they are producing insulin as a type 1. So they're still classified as it, because unless you have a program for 30 years, I believe, to actually get going, you have to say, well, somehow we've managed to make them produce their own insulin.
And people can find out that information from our newsletter, can't they?
Yes, that would be one case. In the type 2s, now, I don't want to break the story that's going to come out this month, but there's something a little more advantageous to a type 2 in the science side of it. Now, what I have forgotten to bring up is the MODY and the LADA. The MODY, maturity onset diabetes for the young. LADA is the late onset diabetes, let's say, for the older people, because you're getting a lot of people, let's say probably 1-2% of the population that carry a gene, which is a diabetes gene, and it has to be passed from one to the other. Well, that was science that just wasn't known, but it's part of DRF's program. So seeing recently some things about that, there's a place for them. So anybody with diabetes, and let's not forget the carer, we're giving them more information. And I think when you have, you're striving to stay alive until a cure is found, let's say, you've got these other things that are happening.
And so I have to ask you about Captain Insulin.
Yes. Now, that was an interesting idea with Lee, and her name's Claire. She came up with this idea, something for the children and everything, of wearing the Captain Insulin outfit. Okay, it was a flash outfit, but somebody put a nice logo on there, DRWF, and I wear it with pride. I guess it's like becoming a mascot for the every. It's a bit like, here I am, a civilian now, out of the service, but when I put on that uniform, I'm back in the Air Force. So when I put the Captain Insulin on, I'm representing diabetes. And so, it's funny. You're just the suit. It's like acting. You are now the character as soon as you put the suit on and all. And yeah.
So you've worn it several times, haven't you?
I have. I take a lot of care of it because you never know quite how long it'll last. But it seems to be so popular that there's requests for it at different intervals.
So you were wearing it recently at the Diabetes Wellness Day South.
Yes.
Tell me what happened on the smoking cessation stand.
We had the great battle. And it's funny how it sort of came together. Norma Jane put on the big sig, I think it was. Yes, put the big sig on. And there was nothing, a whole lot. Let's say everybody was there at the exhibition. People had gone upstairs to the various places. And we had this little devilish thing of, oh, let's start something. So she gets on the outfit, I get on the outfit, and all of a sudden everybody's taking pictures of us with this battle. The only thing missing, which she said she's going to bring next year.
Oh, is it the rematch next year?
Rematch, but she's going to put some boxing gloves on. Just to make it a bit. Yes.
So we can advertise it now that you'll be at the Diabetes Wellness Day South for the rematch.
Yes.
Fantastic. Of course, you won, didn't you?
I won, yes. This was it. It was a defeat. But the toughest part of doing it, I could not stop laughing. I'm glad there was no sound coverage of it because I just couldn't stop laughing as we went along. It was just so funny. But to be able to pose in the various positions, let's say, of defeating the big cigarette and all that. And I just had no idea how popular that was going to be from that moment until afterwards. It was just something to do to, let's say, how would you get it? You've got a crowd now. Well, you may as well entertain them.
Fantastic.
Linwood comes to the days and sometimes he vanishes and Captain Insulin appears. As if by magic.
Lee is particularly involved in developing our wellness days.
Captain Insulin's a great character. He's it's something we asked Linwood to do quite a few years back when we had families and children at the wellness days and they were doing activities and we wanted a fun character for them because they were toddlers. And Linwood took that on and has got this superhero costume that he's adapted and turned into Captain Insulin. But yeah, I think it brings a different element to the events, a bit of fun, still drawing attention to what's important. And Linwood really enjoys being Captain Insulin as well. In terms of the events, they're all about teaching people with all sorts of diabetes, type 1, type 2, LADA, MODY, people's families and friends that, you know, maybe carers for them, or partners that have to cook dinner and watch things like diet and exercise and things that are going on in the family. And what we do at the days, at the events, is work with the NHS. We'll do talks, interactive workshops, and all of the different key topics around diabetes. So all of the important things like looking after your eyes, foot care, blood glucose testing, diet, nutrition, exercise, all of the things people need to know about to effectively manage their diabetes. Those are usually managed by healthcare professionals, diabetes healthcare professionals that we work with. We'll also have an exhibition room where we'll feature diagnostic companies, the healthcare teams again, diabetes related companies, support groups and charities. So we try to involve and include as much as we can at those events to give people the tools, the knowledge and the practical things they need to manage their diabetes better. I guess I would say, if people haven't been to one of our diabetes wellness days before, just come along and try one out. You know, they're great days. They're very relaxed in style. We don't put any pressure on anybody. You can come along and you can learn as much or as little as you like. If you don't want to go to a workshop or sit in a talk, you can just visit the stands and speak to the professionals and the diagnostic reps. You can take part in an exercise class, perhaps watch a cooking demonstration, or even just pop along and have a cup of coffee, meet other people with diabetes, and then go home. So we let people set their own agenda. We don't beat them over the head with the diabetes stick. They can come along and they can get as much or as little out of the event as they like.
How expensive are they to attend?
They're not at all. The charity subsidises attendance through our educational aims. So all we ask people for is a £5 registration fee, but that includes the whole day, all of the exhibition stands and the exhibition room, the talks and the workshops. We put on tea and coffee all day, biscuits, sugar-free ones, and a nice lunch, and people get a delegate bag to take away. And then after the event, we produce a nice printed hard copy of all the key messages and top tips from the day, just to refresh people's knowledge on what they learnt and help them keep managing their diabetes.
And it's an award-winning event, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, we won a Quality in Care QIC award. We got a highly commended, and we also won the Judges Special Award. So we beat NHS teams from all over the country, and we won the award for empowering people with diabetes. So educating people, empowering them to take control of their diabetes and manage it as best as they can.
Lee Calladine.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
Our next Diabetes Wellness Day is in the Midlands on the 6th of October at Chesford Grange, Kenilworth. Then our Diabetes Wellness Day North in Hartlepool on the 9th of November. More details on the website at drwf.org.uk. And while you're there, you may like to sign up to our monthly newsletter from just £8 a year. Or make a donation. Please include the gift aid if you are eligible. For the more energetic, there are some great activities and events coming up to raise funding for us through sponsorship, such as the Cardiff Half Marathon in October. You can get in touch with us for more details, fundraising ideas, or to ask for support on an event in which you are already participating. Call our office on 02392 637 808. Standard call rates apply.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
Even when your diabetes is managed well, unexpected illness can have an adverse effect, and when you're setting off on a two-week leg of an ocean race, the preparation is intense. A year ago, British TV presenter Dom Littlewood, who has type 1, was in New York preparing to cross the Atlantic on the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race. This is what he told us then.
Well, I sail anyhow, but I've never, ever done proper sailing. I sail the Mediterranean, where you get dolphins jumping in front of your boat, and the sun's shining, and you've got a fishing rod out the back, and a nice bottle of beer open, and you've got your feet on the helm, and you sail along. And that, to me, is really, really enjoyable sailing. That's what I'm very passionate about. This is hardcore. This is an ocean. There's only five in the world. I've never sailed one of them. I'm ticking the box here with the Atlantic. I'm really, really looking forward to it. But of course, I've got the trepidation. That's probably one of my biggest concerns, is we're going to be in the middle of an ocean. If something goes wrong, then, you know, it's not like you can suddenly call an ambulance or, call a rescue helicopter. You'd be too far for that. So I've had to give that a lot of thought, a lot of attention. Now, I've recently started using a CGM, a constant glucose monitoring kit, which is Dexcom. It's just there on my side. Now, that to me is going to be a little bit like a guardian angel, because one, it will send signals to my phone, but if I don't want to have my phone on me on deck, which I probably won't, I've got another little device which receives the signals, and I can set parameters on that. It can tell me if I'm high, low, if I've got a rapid rate increase or a rapid decrease, and if it hits certain levels which I've set, it will send warnings out to me. It will vibrate and it will give me an audible warning. So I'm going to carry that on me in a waterproof case, and that to me is something which I think is going to be a big help. And that's what I've learned over the years. I've had it 43 years now, diabetes. I don't remember life without it, is respect it. So, it's a challenge, and it's full of highs and lows, and, you know, I'm really, really looking forward to it.
So, with great anticipation, Dom departed Manhattan to head out into the Atlantic. But within a few days, they were in perfect storm territory and weathering out rough seas. The majority of the crew were hit by seasickness, and it took its toll on Dom. As captured by TV crew on board filming the documentary series, The Race of Their Lives.
We are 5 days at sea, about 1,000 miles away from New York. We had a very treacherous stretch of water where most people got very ill and started to feel the effects of the Atlantic. My diabetes, I got into a bit of a problem with it, and I've now got what's called ketones in my blood, which is basically a poison.
The skipper liaised with medics ashore to get a professional assessment.
We've got a bit of an incident. Dominic, as you know, his blood sugars have been a little bit erratic with his seasickness, and now it's affected his ketones. The ketones, once they get into your blood, start to break down your liver and your kidneys, and it becomes very, very serious. So with consultation with Praxis, the race office, we've decided before we go out and venture across the big pond is to get him off.
I've got a standing pulse of 124, which is not particularly good. What I suspect is going to happen is they will take me in and analyse me, probably put me on an IV drip of saline and perhaps a glucose solution, because I haven't been eating very well for the last couple of days. Very, very sad day for me. I was really, really enjoying every moment of my time aboard the boat. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll be able to do it again. But for the time being, you know, my experience of a lifetime ends in Newfoundland.
Dom was soon back to good health and has returned to British TV screens. Diabetic ketoacidosis can present serious challenges, and next month we'll look at this complication in greater detail. Plus, we'll hear what happened when Linwood was diagnosed with cancer and how the resulting treatment affected his diabetes.
And on my father's birthday, I was told that I had myeloma, but when he explained it to me, he said it's blood cancer and bone marrow cancer. And I thought, well, at that particular time, I feel no different than I am now talking to you.
Linwood is also a mentor for people living with diabetes, and DRWF's Lee Calladine, who has type 1, explains how valuable this can be from a personal perspective.
You know, it's a really scary thing to live with, especially when you're newly diagnosed. you might feel completely at a loss. Suddenly you're confronted with this medical condition that you may have for the rest of your life. People that take on their diabetes on board and manage it really well are great peer support for other people with diabetes.
There'll be a look at the current research DRWF is supporting. Plus, we'll hear more from Hannah and Jane on retinopathy, continuing the focus on our eyes in our Staying Well feature.
HbA1c is the biggest modifiable risk factor for retinopathy. So for every little bit you can get that down and steady, it does pay off in the long run and it reduces the risk of any complications.
This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks to all the people who talked to me this month and also to you for listening. I'm looking forward to you joining us again in our next edition of Living with Diabetes.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora Media production for DRWF. Copyright 2019. Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.